Let's go through every single package installed on a Linux install DVD, specifically Slackware 14.2. Of course, these are all open source packages that I'm talking about on this show, so they probably can still apply to you even if you're not running Slackware and even if you're not running Linux. These are open source packages, so you can download the source code and run them on any computer, whether you're running Linux, Mac, Windows, BSD, doesn't matter. You can learn probably something from this episode. So let's get started. Today's first application is Itinerary. Itinerary is, well, sort of an awkward application to talk about at this point because I haven't traveled since 2019, I guess. So this application is largely useless to me currently, but I'm glad to have found it because when I start traveling again eventually, this is the kind of application I would love to have. I wish I'd had this much, much earlier. There's a companion app to this app that I would also want, and maybe it exists. I haven't seen it, but it is something that I would like. But anyway, first let's talk about the one that exists. It's called KDE Itinerary. You launch it, and you get a little helpful-ish message about how to use it, which is you can import data. And you can import data either by opening a PDF ticket, a plane ticket, a train ticket, however you travel, boat ticket, like ferry. And it will apparently parse that PDF and put it into your itinerary. Alternately, you can import travel appointments, I guess, or events from an Android calendar, from entries made through Kmail, through Nextcloud or Thunderbird, as long as those are synchronized over, and accessible over DAV, web DAV, or I guess DAVX5, which I don't actually know what that is. I'm assuming it's a form of web DAV or I guess DAV protocol. So I'd not seen the X superscript 5 before, but I'm sure that it's something very exciting. I don't use DAV that much, to be honest. Or you could connect or transfer information through KDE Connect using the Kmail itinerary plugin, which I have not been able to find, or by scanning a boarding pass barcode and pasting the contents that you get when you scan the barcode. Those are all the ways that you can get information into itinerary. Bizarrely, manual entry is not an option. So that feels a little bit weird to me that you can't enter the data into the application. It feels very much kind of like a viewer application. I guess as if though, let's say, you might wonder, well, why can't I create an image in GwenView? GwenView is an image viewer. Why can't I create an image there? Well, you can't. You can view it. That's what Itinerary is. It's a travel plan viewer, and that's it. So that's a little bit limiting from the standpoint of, well, if you don't have anything in your itinerary scheduled for traveling that itinerary, the KDE itinerary, could parse, then you can't really see itinerary in action, and that's where I am right now, pretty much. So that's fine. The gist of it, I've got. And there is a way to get itinerary, KDE itinerary, on your mobile device, which is kind of neat. It's a little bit of a roundabout way. You have to go to the KDE F-Droid release repository. So Itinerary isn't on F-Droid, which the F-Droid is, in case you don't know, is an open source, a free and open source repository, Android application repository for free and open source applications. Meaning F-Droid itself is free and open source. You install that onto Android and then you have access to a bunch of free and open source applications, as if though it was a Google Play Store or whatever, but instead it's F-Droid. Itinerary isn't in F-Droid, but KDE maintains an FDroid, I guess, compatible repository for releases, and you can go there and download the application that you want and install it on your Android, assuming you have the ability to install an APK through Android. I know some Android phones don't sort of give you that access, or I mean, technically they do, but it's restricted through some policy on that device. I mean, either way, it doesn't really matter, because, I mean, it's not like getting it on your device unlocks special features of the desktop application. It is the same application. It's just, instead of being on your desktop, it's on your phone, which I think is still useful, because if you're traveling, you might not have your KDE laptop with you. I wouldn't, if I were traveling, to be honest. By default, I would take my work laptop, and my work laptop runs GNOME 3, so having itinerary on my phone would actually be quite nice. I mean, obviously I could install it on my work laptop, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, realistically, just for an itinerary app, I could see it being on a mobile device being very useful. So that's itinerary. I don't have PDFs to import. I don't have anything to really to import into it at all. And even on the phone, there's an added option to check a calendar. But, like, there's nothing on my calendar for traveling. It just doesn't, it's just not something that I'm doing right now, so it's not very useful to me. But it is a very cool application. I would love it if KDE would come out with a travel expenses tracker. That would be really nice. Because if you travel for work, then you know that one of the fun administrative tasks you get to do during your trip and after your trip, and then probably again after your trip because you did it wrong the first time, and so your finance department gets back to you and asks you for clarity or for more receipts or something like that, is you get to track all your expenses. Like if you grab a bagel in the airport because you know you're not going to get anything on the plane, or if you get a coffee at the airport because why not, then it's just, it would be really nice to have a little application where I could scan that receipt and throw the receipt away and not have to carry it around and try to sort through it at the hotel later. So that would be a very cool addition or companion app to itinerary. But that's not something that exists right now in itinerary, and I don't know of an application currently that does offer that stuff. But itinerary is really a nice looking app. It's a really, I could see it being a very useful app, not for me right now, but eventually, again, maybe it will be useful. So that's itinerary. Check it out if you travel. Next up is Juke, or Yuck. I'm not really sure how you say it. J-U-K. And Juke, or Yuck, or whatever, is a, it's a music playing application, much sort of, I was about to say much like Elisa, but that's not quite right. It is not much like Elisa. It is, I would say, a simpler application. It was something that I was using for quite a while until I finally just switched over to Elisa when Slackware 15.0 came out. And I've already raved, I think, about Elisa in the previous episode. I hope I got it across how much I was really enjoying Elisa, and that is so true. I may as well just say it again. Since using Elisa, I have sort of, as the Amarok subtext subtitle goes, I have rediscovered my music. Like, it's just been so fantastic. I have discovered so many albums that just kind of get lost in the text shuffle of a file system, but sort of ping your interest again once you have the album cover right there on your screen staring at you. And that is something, again, kind of missing from Juke. Juke is, it really is more like a jukebox, because that's kind of, or maybe it's, maybe it's less than a jukebox, because now that I'm thinking about it, I should probably look for some images here on DuckDuckGo for jukebox images. I think jukeboxes generally, don't they show you the album cover in that top part? No, they don't. Okay, never mind. Okay, so it is like a jukebox. I haven't seen a jukebox in ages myself. I mean, now I have because I just searched for images of them. But isn't that funny? I thought maybe they were album covers in that top part, but it doesn't look like they are. Yeah, it looks like it's just a big list of songs that you can choose from. And that's what Juke is. That is exactly, that's the interface of Juke. I mean, it is a text list in one window. It is a bunch of playlists on the left. And then I think optionally, I think that's how I usually have it laid out. I was thinking there was a third panel, but I don't actually think there is. So it's that simple. When you first launch Juke, it will ask you where you keep your music. It defaults to /home/your username/music. So if that's where you keep your music, then that's, you can have it there. You could also add folders, though. You don't only have to have one. So you could have some of your music in home user, or, you know, /music. You could have some on an external drive. You could have some elsewhere. So you could add, you can add a whole array of locations for that. And then you could also choose folders within that or outside of that to exclude from being searched for music. So if some folder keeps coming up, you know, for whatever reason, maybe like audiobooks, for instance, maybe you have a bunch of audiobooks and you keep that in your music folder, but you don't really want access to that in your jukebox, then you could exclude that folder, that subdirectory. After it scans your music collection, then it launches, and that takes a little while, obviously, because it's parsing your file system and all of the metadata and all that other good stuff. It pops up the normal player that you'll interact with on a regular basis, and that is, as I say, something on the left for your playlists. It defaults to a collection list, so that's everything in your music collection, as defined by the folders that you've pointed to as your music folders. And then from there, and on the in the collection list on the in the right panel, you'll see all of the songs in the collection list. To create a new collection, or as we more often call them, a playlist, you click on the left panel and you create new empty playlist. You can also create a search playlist and a playlist from a folder, both of which are really great little features. So an empty playlist is an empty playlist. You can add whatever songs you want to that playlist, and that'll contain those songs. A search playlist is, as you might guess, it's a playlist containing the results of a specific search. So if you know you want to add all of I'm thinking of like a dozen artist names, none of which sound like words. So like there's IO. I don't know, you know, that's a name of an artist, but does that really mean anything to you? So anyway, you could add, let's say, Western Pennsylvania you could search for Western Pennsylvania. It'll come up with a bunch of songs or a couple of songs, because their songs typically are quite long. And that becomes the playlist. So that's kind of nice, because that kind of limits the selection. There's also the ability to just search through the track list like manually and then play from there. You don't have to make a playlist. You could just literally do a search and then play what you find. There's also the playlist from a folder. So if you keep your albums or your songs or your music, whatever, in directories that are then in, within subdirectories that maybe limit those songs by that artist to a specific album, or maybe it's a mood playlist that you want. That you have a relaxation playlist or something like that, or a folder of relaxing music or something, and you could make that a playlist because it's a folder. So it can generate a playlist from that folder. So there's I think a pretty reasonable sort of system for creating playlists. I quite like that. I think they could probably go further and make a couple more, but I feel like that's actually a pretty good range to select from, and I feel like that's a lot sort of stronger than Elisa's playlist ability. That said, it's not something in practice I personally need for Elisa. Well, for anything, as I've said, I think before, I really listen to whole albums. I don't pick and choose songs. I'm not really a mixtape type of person. So I just listen to stuff by album. I mean, half the time I've ripped CDs as a single track that contains all of the tracks, or maybe sometimes two. If I know it was a vinyl, I'll do a side A and a side B, so two tracks per album, something like that. But I don't pick and choose, so I don't tend to do a lot of playlists. And in fact, when I was using Juke, I generally just had one playlist, and the playlist was just essentially a Yeah, I would clear the playlist every time, every time I launched the application, pretty much, and then I would add the things into that playlist that I wanted to listen to, and then when I was done, I would clear it and add more stuff, So it was really just kind of like the staging ground for what was going to play for the next hour or 2 hours, and then it would get refreshed because I don't use playlist functionality all that much, other beyond just knowing that I need to play some music. So the other feature of Juke, which is quite nice, is an built-in tagging system. So I said on Elisa that I spent a good week or two, 8 hours a day for every day of the week, practically. Not really, but I mean, it was a long time. I spent a long time on it, retagging all of my music, like my entire collection of, I don't know, 15,000 songs or 30,000 songs or whatever it is, I forget. But I retagged everything because, yeah, it was probably more like 15,000, because like I say, I know I don't have 15,000 albums, and I do rip a lot of albums as single tracks. Anyway, whatever it is, I retagged like a lot of it, and I used EasyTag and KID3 tag, or no, KID3, I think is what it's called, to help me with that. But Juke actually has it all sort of built in. It's right there at the bottom, or you can reveal the tagging interface, and it just pops up into the Juke window, and whatever song you have selected, you are able to see the tags as they exist, and then edit them as you please. So that's kind of nice. There's also a tag guesser, so that if you have a bunch of things that you want to tag, they're named consistently. A lot of times you can just have Juke try to guess those tags from the file name. So that's quite nice. Juke, it's very nice. It's a good application. Like I say, I'm not actually using it anymore, but it was the player that I had switched to sort of in that lull between 14.2 and 15.0. And by that lull, I'm talking about, I think, sort of the year-long lull that maybe this podcast was sort of aware of. I started predicting 15.0 probably about a year before it actually happened. So from that time on, I think I started using Juke. I don't remember what the impetus for that was. I mean, really, for the longest time, VLC was my go-to player for all my music. To be fair, I think that a big reason for that was just because VLC, I knew beyond
any doubt that it could play all of the music that I had, whether it was an MP3 from ages ago, an Aug, an Opus, the M4A, FLAC, whatever format the music was in. I knew that VLC would be able to handle it, and that just kind of removed the layer of having to think too hard about, hey, I want to hear this album right now, let me throw it into a player. But I guess at some point, like, it all kind of leveled out, and I haven't had to struggle with codec recognition in ages. I don't remember the last time, so not that big of a deal. And it just seems like whatever application I open, I can use for my music. And so I decided, why not use a KDE specific app so that it ties in with the little multimedia widget up in my system tray. Now, if you don't use KDE, you may not know about this little widget, but there is a little icon in your system tray that is either a play button or a pause button. This is assuming you have a media player launched. And by media player, I mean Elisa, Juke, Dragon, probably other things that I'm not thinking of right now. But anything that ties in, I guess probably to Dbus or something. I don't really know. I haven't looked into it. That'll trigger that little icon. And that way you have a centralized location to control your whatever multimedia is playing. Like I say, it can be video or audio, and sometimes I do watch movies or TV series as I am working, just sort of as background noise. So it's kind of nice to have that widget up there. My new keyboard that I got, which I talked about in a previous episode, it has a multimedia button so that I can skip tracks and pause and play. So that's nice as well. So I've got a lot of controls in a lot of places. Quite nice, quite useful, very handy to have. So Juke and Elisa both do tie into that widget, so it feels, once again, very integrated, if I haven't used the word integrated enough when praising KDE. Then there it is again. It's integrated. Okay, so that's Itinerary and Juke. Let's go have coffee. And I'm looking forward to coffee, actually, because I got a really, really great coffee the other day. And then we'll come back and we'll talk about K3B. So the other day, we're back, by the way. The other day, I decided to try a different coffee than I usually get, mostly because the coffee that I usually get is an hour away. I just haven't had a chance to go an hour away lately, and it didn't look like we were going to get out to the hour away store anytime soon. And I was running low on coffee, so I wasn't going to obviously let that happen. I wasn't going to run out. So I decided to try like a mail order coffee. So I went online and looked around. And in New Zealand, there is a place called Flight Coffee, apparently. Just learned about it last week. Now I know it exists. It is not terribly close to me. In fact, it's all the way on the north. It's on the north tip of the North Island. I'm pretty close to the south tip of the South Island. Not quite. You can still go south from where I am, but I'm pretty darn far south. So anyway, it's not close, but I mean, it's in New Zealand, and I figured why not give it a try? Because they are selling through, over the internet. I can buy a kilo of coffee and have it sent to me. So I looked through their offerings, and I found one called Milky, I think is what it's called, and I thought that sounded good, and so I ordered a kilo. And they sent it to me, and it arrived pretty promptly. And I have to say, it's amazing. I mean, it tastes reminiscent, I will say, of, I think it's called Yirgacheffe, which I had, I think that's what it's called. Which I had back in Pittsburgh at a cafe called 61C, which is practically where I used to live. And it was a great coffee. Like, I really enjoyed that coffee. It was one of my favorites. It was a little bit, tended to be a little bit on the dark side, the way that 61C served it, which could be good, could be bad, depending on what you're looking for. But it had, like, Yirgacheffe had this sort of almost a back flavor to it that would kind of creep up as you drank, and it was a re it's a really smooth and mild flavor, which is what I love, and it was just so nice. But I haven't had that in ages now. I mean, certainly not from Pittsburgh, but I mean, just in general, I haven't had it in ages. But this coffee is a little bit reminiscent of it. I mean, for all I know, it is it. I mean, Yirgacheffe is like a region of, you know, from somewhere in Africa. And that's where the coffee comes from. So, I mean, for all I know, this could be that. Maybe that's why it's reminiscent of it. But it also, frankly, reminds me of my old real favorite, Sawtooth Mountain Mud, which I had in, I think, Joshua Tree, California, a long time ago. And it was, I mean, it is just the smoothest cup of coffee you could ever imagine. This comes really close to that, to Sawtooth. It's just so good, and I'm of course drinking it out of my new favorite mug, so it's even better than probably it would be in some other mug. So I don't know if you're, I guess, ever in New Zealand, go to Flight Coffee in Auckland and pick up a cup of their milky coffee, I think is what like that's the name of the blend or whatever. I don't know why they call it that. I mean, they had to call it something. And it's really, really good. So let's talk a little bit about K3B. K3B is, I think, arguably one of the star applications of KDE. I mean, it is one of those applications that, well, it used to, I mean, it was the KDE app that everyone had installed no matter what, because it just made interactions with optical media, and I'll get to what that means in a moment, so easy. It just made it so simple. And it continues to do that to this day. Optical media, in case you don't know, they're little metal discs, round little metal discs. They look a lot like coasters. They're not very good as coasters. I've tried it. It's not, they don't absorb moisture, so you tend to just get sort of a lot of condensation dripping from your glass onto the metal disc, and then what do? So not great as a coaster, but that's what it looks like. And you put them into an optical media drive. They were commonly called CDs and DVDs, and I guess Blu-rays and other things like that. But that's, well, mini disc. So that's kind of what K3B did. Was it made it so that you could read and copy and write to CDs and DVDs, or rather CDRs and DVDRs, because I mean, it's CD and DVD implies actually a read-only media, but the CDR, is that right? Yeah, CDR. What did the R stand for? Surely that was read. Oh no, recordable maybe. But then what was RW? Rewritable? I don't know. Anyway, ancient media that nobody really uses anymore except me, because I just installed 15.0 via DVD. Although I did also install it, if you'll recall, over the USB stick as well. So anyway, it's an old media, and sometimes you have to write data to them. And if you want to do that, K3B is the way to do it, but it does so much. So when you launch K3B, and this is one of the great interfaces, I think. I mean, it's a very, if you look at it, you're gonna think, oh my gosh, it looks like KDE 3.0 is still alive and kicking, because it does have that kind of feel to it. It is, I wouldn't say it had a super modern look and feel, and yet it is super effective. You launch K3B, and the first thing you see, well, the first thing you might see is a permission error. Because if you are not added to the correct group for K3B, then K3B will not have access to, or you at the controls of K3B will not have access to important applications that K3B uses in the background. So like the CDR, whatever, the CDR tool kit that we talked about way back in episode whatever, it uses those libraries to manipulate data to and from CDs and DVDs. And if you're not in the correct group to make that happen, then you have to add yourself to that group. It's something I did a long time ago now, and I don't, well, I'm not seeing the error now, so I guess I must have done it maybe when. No, that wouldn't make sense. I guess it must just work on 15.0, I guess. Or maybe you see that error after you start using the thing. I don't know. I think it came up pretty early in 14.2, so maybe it's all fixed or all sorted now. It wasn't broken, but maybe it's something that's a preset now in 15.0. I don't know. But if you see an error, just add yourself to the appropriate group. It's not a big deal. It's pretty simple. So, let's see. So you've got an interface here. You've got kind of a weird sort of tree view of your. I mean, the view isn't weird, but it's just weird that this is on the top to me. But on the top, you've got sort of the indication of an optical disc. Now, on mine, it's currently saying no medium is present because I don't have an optical drive right now. And under that, you have a bunch of folders, all the folders in your home directory. But you have access to other places as well. So you got that. And then on the right top, you've got sort of like an empty space, which you could imagine, and you'd be correct, that was kind of the building area for the CD or the DVD that you're about to write. So it's the data area that's going to get written to a disk, the playlist, as it were. And maybe the literal playlist in case, if you're making an audio CD, which is K3B is great for that as well, by the way. Okay, so on the bottom though, that's the real star of this application. It is, it says, "Welcome to K3B, the CD, DVD, and Blu-ray creator." Creator spelled with a K. So the three dedicated options are new data project, new audio CD project, and copy media or copy medium. And a new data project will sort of get K3B into the mode of understanding that it's going to write files, bit for bit files, to a optical device. New audio CD kicks it over into audio CD mode so that it knows that it's not going to copy the file. I mean, it is going to copy the files, but it's not going to copy the files. It's going to copy the contents of the files as audio data onto an optical media. And then copy medium puts it into the mode of, okay, well, first I need to read a optical device and then store that somewhere, and then I'm going to write it to a blank optical device or medium. So those are the three top options. But then there's more actions, and if you click on that, you get a good idea of just how much you can do with K3B. There's new data project, continue multi-session project. That was sort of a, not a hack, but a method of doing optical media where you could write a little bit to the media and then use the media and then come back and append more to it and then use the media and then append more multi-session. So you could do several. You could write stuff to it, which I mean, I know, I realize as I say this, and I think everyone realized at the time that that just seems very primitive. Like that, the fact that you would get excited about being able to append data to your media later seems really primitive. It seemed primitive at the time. It was not elegant. Optical media is not an elegant solution. It's a horrible solution. It turns out to have not really been as durable as all the advertisements were claiming. I remember Kodak media advertisements saying, "If you use our optical media, you're guaranteed, your data is guaranteed for 100 years, literally 100 years." I wish I'd clipped that ad. And of course, no, that never happened. The CDs degrade, the metal flakes. It's just horrible. So anyway, That was a multi-session project. Then there's the new audio CD project, new mixed mode CD project. So you could have audio and data. So that was kind of cool. A couple of bands actually did do that back in the, I don't know, early 2000s or so, probably. They would have like, here's our new album. Here's 60 minutes of music. And if you put it into your computer, you'll get 20 minutes or 10 minutes or, you know, 5 minutes of, I don't know, like a music video, a little tiny music video at 320 by 240 pixels or whatever. Or here, you know, there'd be a PDF of some things or whatever, really. I mean, it was a data CD. They could put whatever they wanted to onto it. So there's that. So then there's a new video CD project, new video DVD project, new eMovie, no, sorry, eMovix project. I don't know what that is. Copy medium, format, erase, rewritable disk. So again, some optical medias were rewritable. You could format them and then write more, you know, write new data to them. Of course, those always had problems as well because some optical drives wouldn't read those kinds of data, those disks, so they were useless to you, or something thought it had been rewritten, but then it didn't really get rewritten, or it didn't get formatted. It was just horrible, horrible. CDs and DVDs are horrible. Just don't explore this at all. Burn image, so if you have a .img or a .iso, you could just burn it bit for bit to an optical media. So you're just copying an ISO. That was how Linux was distributed for a very long time. Linux distribution would give you the .iso. You would take it into K3B and go to burn image. You would select the .iso on your hard drive, select the media in your optical media drive, and now you've got a distribution on a disk. It was great. That was actually really nice. I mean, it's no nicer than having a USB stick with a distribution on it. But as I said before, in the Slackware 15.0 episode, I think, there is something about having a disk on your shelf so that whenever you need it, for whatever reason, it's there. Whereas, you know, if you're going to put it on a USB drive, it's going to get rewritten the next day. You're not going to keep it on that USB drive. It's just, I don't know, it's the form factor or something. Maybe we need CD-sized USB sticks. It's a horrible idea. Don't do that, anybody. And then there's RIP audio CD, RIP video CD, RIP video DVD. So sort of a handbrake situation. If you need stuff off of the optical media, you could do that. You could extract audio from a CD. You could extract video from a video CD. I've never actually seen a video CD, I don't think, myself. But I understand that they were things, I think, more prevalent in Europe. And then there was, of course, RIP video DVD. DVD video is pretty prevalent. There's usually encryption on video DVDs, a system called CSS, confusingly. It has nothing to do with the web style sheet format. I think it was called I'm pretty sure it was called CSS. Very confusing. So getting around that sometimes could be tough. Handbrake kind of came in and made it pretty easy, to be honest. But I guess you could do it in K3B as well. So that's K3B. I mean, really, there's not a whole lot else to it. It does what it does, and it does it really well, and it does it very clearly. And I think that was the really big kind of feature of K3B, was that you didn't have to think too hard about this very common sort of everyday process, and that wasn't necessarily the case with the terminal commands. I mean, you can go back and listen to the episodes where I do the terminal commands. They're not actually hard, but if you're not used to it, or if you don't do it all the time, you know, often enough to develop sort of a casual familiarity with it, then sometimes, yeah, something like K3B can just make it super easy, and you just don't stress about it. You just think, oh, cool, I'll just fire up K3B and do the thing that I need to do. K3B on this install, if I go to settings, K3B devices, it identifies that I have a DVD drive? Do I? I don't have a DVD drive. Hold on, let me look at something. I absolutely do have a DVD drive. I forgot. I forgot that I had a DVD drive. I do not know where this came from. It is in my tower. I must have put it in there when I was putting in my new NVMe drive for 15.0. That's really funny. I honestly forgot. I thought my only DVD drive was a USB one that is sitting in a drawer, just out of reach. So, okay. So I do have a DVD drive, and it's telling me what this drive is. It is a DVD plus negative RW TS-H653F Foxtrot. D200 is the firmware, and the write capabilities are DVD-R, DVD-RW, DVD plus RW, DVD plus R, DVD plus R dual layer. Oh my gosh, and it keeps going on. Okay, well, you get the idea. A bunch of CD formats as well. The read capabilities encompass that and then go beyond that. Buffer size is 2 MB. Does it support burn free? Yes, it does. I don't know what that means. And then this is the part that I was actually getting to. The write modes are SAO, TAO, RAW, SAO. You'll remember these maybe from the terminal commands. A lot of those are the CDR DAO, CD record, CDR skin, CDR or rather well, make ISOFS, and so on. So all of those things K3B has access to, and it could have access to more. Like if you had apparently VCDXRIP installed, it could use that. I don't know what that is. I don't have it installed. Transcode, not, I don't have that installed right now, so it's not found, and so on. So it has a bunch of things that it has access to, and there's a list of permissions in the programs, so it sees that I have permissions correctly applied, but it can help you apply those if you don't, and so on. And of course, I mean, you can, this is an application, so you could start building a project and then save that project before writing it and then come back to it later. So there is a concept of sort of, optical media projects that aren't ready to be burned yet, but do exist. And I think that's about it. So yeah, it's a great application. And like I say, it was one of those, I think, that really kind of set KDE in a way apart because it was just such a powerful application. And I mean, other desktops in Linux had other optical media interface applications. It wasn't like K3B was the only one in town, at least not as far as I remember. What was it, Bracero for GNOME? So, they were there, but K3B, I think it just really had everything, and the workflow was so clear that I think it won a lot of people over. It won a lot of allegiance for a long time, and I think the only reason it sort of lost allegiance insofar as it has is that just optical media just isn't really a thing anymore. And if it is, it is true. I mean, I think the less we use optical media, the less we do with optical media. So, for instance, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, you might have. You might have an RW disk and an RW or an and an R disk and and something that you need to rip. You've got all these different things and you're doing all these different activities. You're making an audio CD today and then an MP3 CD for that fancy new player that actually reads MP3s. So you're putting 100 songs on that one and only the 12 songs on this audio one for your car because your car doesn't read the MP3s, but it does do the audio. And you're just crossing your fingers that it'll actually read a CDR drive because apparently the dies were different and sometimes you wouldn't have any luck with them. And then you're ripping something from this, so, and you're doing a data project over here. So like all of these different activities required a very robust application, and that's what K3B is, whereas a lot of other applications, to my memory, they were a little bit less robust. You couldn't quite count on them having the feature that you needed, whereas K3B, it just had all the features. Okay, that's enough of that. So let's talk about K activities. K activities, I'm going to go to less slash var slash log slash packages K activities. Oh, I've got a choice here. Okay, so there's K activities stats and K activities just K activities. Which one am I doing? I'm doing K activities first. This is an API for using and interacting with activities as a consumer application, adding information to them, or as an activity manager. So, as you could probably guess from that description, this isn't like an application that you're going to launch. This is more like a library set and a bunch of header files and some CMake rules, things that we've seen on other packages like what was it? Event viewer or incident reporter or whatever it was called. Little helper, well, FFmpeg thumbnail, certainly. Little helper applications that you don't really interact with directly unless you're developing for KDE. And this is what that provides. It gives your application, your KDE application, or your KDE aware application, if you please, awareness of the activities, what do you call it? Framework, I guess, or subsystem within KDE. And activities in KDE are something that I don't know whether they've quite, I don't know if they've still yet hit their stride. I think everyone who knows about them really, really loves them in concept. I don't know. I have yet to meet anyone who uses them on a daily basis or actually really thrives from using them. And I think that in a weird way, I think a lot of maybe KDE users or a lot of, yeah, maybe a lot of KDE users tend to be, multitaskers. And I know a lot of people say there's no such thing as multitasking, but whatever the case, you might want to have access to different components of your system within your hard within your desktop. And something that deliberately stands in the way of you having access to those things is actually not a feature. And that's kind of what Activities does. So there is an executable that gets installed with this. It's called kactivities-cli, CLI. And it is, as its name implies, a command line interface, a terminal command for K activities. If I do K activities dash dash cli or dash cli space dash dash help, it gives me a little list of the commands. So the most obvious one, I guess, workflow wise, would be list activities. So that's dash dash list activities. And it's telling me that I've got two activities. One is one the current one with the unique ID of 63F80CD blah is called desktop. And another one that's running in the background, but not it's not my current one, with a unique ID is called game. And so those are two activities that I have. And if I were to switch from one activity to the other, then, well, let's do it. So if I hit control, not control tab, what is it? Super Q? No, not Super Q either. I don't know that I have that set up, I guess. I did at one point, but I guess maybe I don't right now. So I'm going to instead just type in activities overview in my menu, and that didn't do it either. Fascinating. Okay, so let's do, oh, it's Alt D today, apparently, in my desktop. Alt Delta. that didn't do it either. All right, I'm going to right-click on my desktop and go to Show Activity Switcher. There we go. Now I've got my Activities panel on my left, and it is showing me that I'm currently using my desktop activity. And then if I switch over to my game activity, hopefully I'm still recording in Audacity, I don't actually know, then I see a new desktop and no applications are running here. It's completely, it's an empty space. And the theory is, the intent, is that I could use this space for some other, well, activity that is separate from my day-to-day activities. So I could launch, well, I guess I'll just open, oh, that's interesting. I just tried to open the desktop window in that activity in Dolphin, and it switched me away from that activity, which seems weird. So, okay, now I've launched a new Dolphin in that activity. So now I've got a Dolphin window open in this activity. And that's the only thing that's open. And now I'm going to right-click on the desktop again, Show Activity Switcher, and go back to desktop. I'm going to switch over to Audacity to make sure that I've actually been recording. And it looks good. It looks like everything's still there. I don't see any big blank moments of silence. I thought that was the case, but I just wasn't sure. So switching between activities, obviously, does not, like, pause the other applications running. It just gives you a fresh view of a desktop that is not, that does not have the same applications shown. So they're still running, obviously, but they're not in front of you. And so, I mean, what's the difference between an activity and a virtual workspace? Well, an activity gives you a bunch of new virtual workspaces, so there's that. But why would you use an activity instead of a virtual workspace? Or why would you use an activity if you have virtual workspaces? Couldn't you just put your other application on some other virtual workspace and then just use that? And I, the way that it was explained, like way back at the KDE 4.0 release event, yeah, 4.0, not 5, back in 2006, was that, you know, the concept was that you would have different activities on your computer, activity spaces, and those would be sort of, they were geared towards, for instance, your work life versus your home life. And so you would grab your laptop and go to work, you would switch over to your work activity, and maybe your work activity, you would have your work email account set up there, and you would be able to use your work applications, your IDE or your Office suite or whatever you're using at work, and that would be that activity. And then when you got home, and your work activity would have an awareness of your work network, so you'd be signed on to the work network at work, and then you would go home and you would switch over to your home activity. And now your home activity would have an awareness of your home network, so you'd be attached to your home network. You would run your home-based applications, your, I don't know, whatever you would run at home, Granitier, and, or what was it called, Granitier, something like that, K-Blocks, a terminal of Firefox, you know, whatever. So there was sort of this concept that you could separate the different aspects of your life into different activities. And that sounds kind of cool, but I think in real life, a lot of us are multitaskers and that's just not convenient. I know that when I'm working, I mean, especially in this day and age when it's, you know, so many people are still working remotely or are just working remotely because that's how they've been working. I'll be working on something and the last thing in the world I really want is to have to switch to a different activity just to check, I don't know, my personal email account or to check a web page for a cool new album on Bandcamp or whatever. So I don't know. I feel like the separation between, I guess, work life and home life on the one hand seems kind of nice, but on the other hand, it's actually just this weird sort of block between just getting the information you want quickly. And to make it a little bit more puzzling, it's not as if though one activity excludes the other activity. For instance, let's say I have switched over to my, I don't know, my gaming activity. Switch over to my gaming activity. If I go to my applications, my favorite applications are the same favorite applications from my other activity. So that hasn't changed. It's still my usual set of applications. If I go down to, I don't know, the development menu, that all of those applications are still there. If I go down to my games application, well, there are my games. There's Lutris. So I could launch that in this activity, but what is, like, why is it significant that it's in this activity? So I don't know that the separation between an activity and a workspace, really, I don't think it's very clear, and it really does seem like activity is just a really complex way to get a new set of virtual workspaces. Whereas I could really kind of imagine, instead of doing that, you would just add more virtual workspaces to your current activity and use it that way. So I'm not 100% sure of about, like, sort of what the activities are really intended for. I feel like they're a good idea. I just don't quite understand. I don't see that they're actually, I don't think they've differentiated themselves enough from just being able to switch to a different virtual desktop, really. Or workspace, whatever we call them now. So yeah, activities are neat. It's a good idea. It's an interesting idea, I should say. If you right click on your activity switcher, wherever that may be, I have it in my top panel now. You can see that there are not a whole lot of options. You can show the current activity icon, show the generic activity icon, and show the current activity name. Those are the two options for that. That's not very useful. You can, yeah, there's not a whole lot there, really. It's just not a whole lot around activities. And activities are kind of crammed into the workspace behavior right under virtual desktops. So yeah, I think there's not a whole lot there yet still. And they've persisted between KDE 4 and 5. So I mean, it's still a subsystem that exists. It is still something. It's a way of I don't want to say the word containerizing, but I mean, a very lightweight kind of containerized appearance. You can kind of separate things, but that separation is very, very surface level. It is almost like just having a show desktop button, where you hide all of your open windows. But then you can open up new windows. So, yeah, I don't know. I want activities to become something, although I don't exactly know what I want it to become. And I don't think, I'm not 100% sure that they are going to become something. But there you go. So, with the kActivities-CLI, you can list activities, you can create a new activity, you can remove an activity by ID, you can start an activity by ID, you can stop an activity by ID, you can show the current activity, you can set the current activity, so you can switch from the terminal, you can go to the next or the previous activity, and a couple of other things, but those are the really, really important ones, I think. And it's nice. It's a nice little robust terminal tool for a graphical tool that I don't know how many of us actually use them in real life. Okay, so that's K activities. Let's see if there's anything that I can knock out in the before we end. That's K activities. Oh, K activity stats. Yeah, let's take a look at that really quick. This is a library for accessing usage data. collected by activity. So this could potentially, once again, be kind of useful. And, you know, it could probably even be, I think, there could be an argument that this would be the reason you would want to use K activities. So here we go. So once again, a bunch of header files, a bunch of CMake modules. And in this case, there are no binaries. But what this gives you access to are the statistics for how often someone is using a specific K activity. So you've got things like K activity stats, export, query, result set, result watcher, result model, and so on. So you've got stats, and I could see someone thinking, okay, well, what I will do is set up a bunch of different activities, one for gaming, one for managing my finances, one for doing office work, one for listening to music would span all those, I would think, whatever, watching movies. And then, so that way you have to, or you don't have to, but you willingly switched to a specific activity to engage in a specific task. And from that, from data collected by how often you're using each activity, you could then sort of understand what you are spending your time on each day. And I know a lot of people do enjoy doing that. That's something that, you know, kind of optimizing their how much they're using something and figuring out, like, what are they spending their time on each day. That's kind of an important thing to some people. So I could see this being useful, although not incredibly useful necessarily, because after all, there's no application, there's no front end for this. There's nothing, you know, it's just a bunch of libraries. So it's not like you could just open up your activity stat viewer or something, at least as far as I know. I'm not seeing anything like that. And just see how that works. Well, you don't have that. Which is too bad. I think that would probably be a very valid argument for activities. I mean, people would still have to remember to switch activities, which I think is part of the problem. But there you go. And then finally, within the K activity realm, there is a K activity manager D, which I don't have access to. It's a systemd service, apparently. There is a user lib64 libexec K activity manager D, which hooks into presumably user lib64 libk activity manager D plugin.so, but that doesn't seem to do a whole lot, and the K activity manager doesn't seem to respond really to any kind of dash H or dash V or anything like that, so I don't know exactly what it is. Yeah, it looks like it depends on libkf5 dbus add-ons and a bunch of Qt5 widgets, as expected. I don't see anything specific. Yeah, I'm not really sure what this does, but it is not launching for me, apparently. Or it has already launched. I guess I could do a man 4K activity manager D. No, doesn't exist. I didn't think it did because I didn't see it in the list. But there you go. Yeah. So that's K activities, really. A little bit difficult to really talk about a whole lot because, like I say, it's just not really... I feel like it is not quite where people want it to be yet, but I do think that eventually it could be somewhere that is useful. And the K activity manager D is supposed to be a system service to manage users' activities, track usage patterns, and so on. But in terms of it being a user facing activity, I don't really see how to make that happen yet. I don't think it quite happens. So for instance, when a user is interacting with a computer, this is the K activities blurb from the KDE GitLab. There are three main areas of contextual information that may affect the behavior of the system: who the user is, where they are, and what they are doing. Activities deals with the last one, that is what they are doing. An activity might be developing a KDE application, studying 19th century art, composing music, or watching funny videos. Each of these activities may involve multiple applications, and a single application may be used in multiple activities. For instance, most activities are likely to involve using a web browser, but different activities will probably involve different websites. K-activities provides the infrastructure needed to manage a user's activities, allowing them to switch between tasks and for applications to update their state to match the user's current activity. This includes a daemon, a library for interacting with that daemon, and plugins for integrating with other frameworks. Now, the other frameworks that it says usage. Most applications that wish to be activity aware want to use K-activities. Consumer, K-activities, consumer, that's the library or the class, to keep track of the user's current activity, and K-activities, resource instances to notify the activity manager of resources the user has accessed. This is not necessary for resources accessed with KIO, as a plugin is provided to do that automatically. So a lot of this sounds like there's a bunch of infrastructure in place, and quite possibly some applications are utilizing that infrastructure. Where you go for the end result seems as yet unclear. Still, it's an interesting idea, and I do hope they continue to work on it. I think it's worth exploring, because maybe it's not in the exact place it wants to be yet. Maybe it's not something that people are finding useful yet, but it really does seem like it could be a powerful tool at some point, just as soon as the developers figure out what they're doing with it. And I think also the users have to figure out how they want to use it, because I don't see myself ever using it, but I can definitely see how other people would find it useful. I think that's everything about K-activities that I've got to say. Actually, probably a little bit more than I really had to say, but it got me thinking. And that's it for this episode then. So thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.